Good morning. Good morning and welcome to another round of InterGen Ed Live Stories, Signs of Faith. I think we maybe drained the sanctuary this morning. I'm not sure if there's anyone in worship, but it's lovely to be together in this space. Let's open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for the stories that bind us together as your people. We thank you for this grand narrative that includes all people of all abilities. We thank you for your redeeming love, your transforming love each day, each week in our lives. We thank you for Hannah's presence today. Bless the words that she shares and bless our hearing. In your son's name we pray, amen. So it's a little bit of a cliche, but I think our next speaker needs no introduction, but I'll do it because she's a wonderful person and she deserves it. So we have Hannah Davis Milson back in the house this morning. As you know, she is a child of this community, this church, a graduate of Princeton High School. She went to Haverford College right down south, got a master's in special education up at Columbia, taught for a few years, and now is a project director at AHRC, which stands for Advocacy, Humanity, Reimagining, and Change. And most recently, she has worked with New York City, developing an internship for the differently abled, and works for a lifelong transition of work and also an emphasis on faith and spirituality. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Corey. And it's so exciting to be back and to see so many faces that that I recognize. And I'm not usually on sort of this side of the, you know, of our community. So it's exciting to be with you all today. I thought I would share a little bit about my life and sort of how I got to where I am today. A little bit about the Partnership for Inclusive Internships, which Corey mentioned is our partnership with New York City government, working to provide internships for people with disabilities. And then something more new in my life, which Corey mentioned, was sort of this faith and spirituality crossover with the work that I've been doing, which is one of those moments where it's like, is God speaking to me through this? And then it sort of happens that way. So I'd love to talk about that with you all as well. So I'll just, you know, start with an introduction. My name is Hannah Davis Milson. I grew up in this church. My family moved to Princeton when I was in the fourth grade. I'm sure many of you remember the day that we came and, you know, my family had to run out to the other office while everyone took a vote whether Pastor Dave was going to be the pastor. And it was this big moment, and I remember being so overwhelmed. Everyone was clapping and so happy, and I was just like sobbing. Oh, this is such a change, and I wasn't prepared for it. But nevertheless, we moved to Princeton, and I have a nice throwback photo for you of that time. I'm sorry, Mom, but this is the only photo I could find of this time. And here's one of me and Olivia from like the really good old days. And I would say growing up in this church community, and I wonder if it's the same for the middle school and high schoolers now, but you know, the memories I have of like our youth group on Wednesday nights and the like really crappy pizza that they would bring in from across the street, but that we waited like all week for, and sort of singing in the choir with Miss Page. And I remember so vividly getting the beads on our crosses. That was like the big deal, to get the beads on your crosses each year. And every year when she brought out the sort of black folders for Christmas, and like that was the moment that Christmas was happening and getting ready for the pageant. Actually, I think I have a photo. Here's Miss Page giving out the, this was a little before my time, but Olivia shared this one with me, but very 90s going on here. And, you know, some other highlights of that time, we took a lot of summer trips. We did a lot of trips to Montreat at that time, which were like the highlight of my life. And I tried to find some good pictures, but they were all like kind of too embarrassing to share. But like of the, you know, how cool we thought we were. And we dressed up every night for worship at Montreat. And our trips to Mississippi right after Hurricane Katrina were some of the highlights of, and sort of faith building for me. I feel like And I wonder if many people feel like this. I've tried a lot since then to sort of build those pieces of faith again in my life, but it's hard to recreate like what youth group can kind of mean at that time. A lot of sort of faith building. And so we had some really like great, wonderful times growing up here, some really hard times. My friend Gabriella Wyatt, her mom passed away when we were in high school, and that was sort of another moment of faith building for us. And so I would say one of the key things that sort of shaped my life more than anything else was meeting my friend Dan Miller. And Dan is a member of our church. He's his mom, Nancy, I'm sure you all know. And meeting Dan has sort of set me on a path to the work that I do now. As Corey mentioned, I became a special education teacher, got my master's degree in intellectual and developmental disabilities. So I'd love to talk a little bit about meeting Dan and sort of where that has taken me. So let me show you a quick video. I have to end this slideshow and go over to it. Sorry. Where did it go? Sorry, I had it up.
Sorry.
That's okay. Here we go. Can you hear it? Hold on. Lauren, can you make it louder? Thank you. I just want to show this video because I think it highlights some things that Dan is all about. He loves music. This video makes me really happy. He's a person that brings a lot of joy to my life. And so I wanted to show this video as sort of an introduction to Dan. So, all right, let's see. Let me start it over for you. There you go. Yeah, so as you know, Dan's an integral member of our community, along with his mom, Nancy. Dan is a person on the autism spectrum and someone I've known since growing up here in Sunday school. He's a few years older than I am, but of course we went through Sunday school together. I think here he is right here in this picture getting his cross. From Miss Page. And, you know, recently I actually spoke with Nancy about how they first started coming to Nassau, which is not something I knew sort of growing up. And I do think it's interesting to, you know, when I say that meeting Dan has sort of shaped my life, it wasn't, it didn't feel like that when I met their family in high school or in middle school. It's something that sort of built over time. And it's been a realization every time I come home, like, oh, wow, this actually had a real impact on my life. But in talking to Nancy, she sort of mentions that originally they first came to Nassau because a friend or a colleague knew that there was great music programs here, so that they started coming when Danny was very young to be involved in the music program, and that early on she wanted to have him involved in Sunday school and simply just said, like, he'll really need some extra support. Could anyone provide that? And that a member of our community jumped right up and said, I can do that. And I think it was Holly, who was an OT. So that was a great sort of connection. And I will talk a little bit about it more, but I think that Nassau Church is sort of ahead of its time in terms of including people with disabilities and the kind of work that has to be done one-on-one to make sure that that happens. But it's interesting to talk to Nancy about how they first sort of got involved, and here we are, you know, 30 years later, and they're really integral parts of our community. Here's a great photo of Dan in high school with Olivia and Liz. And here's Dan and Nancy now. I love this picture. So since meeting Danny when I was in elementary school, I sort of slowly became more involved in working with people with disabilities. I did some volunteering. I worked with Special Olympics, which was great. And I think for the middle school and high school students here, it is one of those things where like I said, there wasn't a moment where I was like, hey, this is really what I want to do. It sort of just kind of happens when you start thinking about what you might be interested in and becoming more and more involved in different volunteer opportunities. And so being alongside Dan really sparked this interest in me that developed into a career. So from sort of volunteering in high school and middle school, I went to Haverford College and I studied education. And I became a special education teacher, and I worked over the summers at a camp that promotes sort of independence and adaptive skills for people with developmental disabilities on Haverford's campus. And after that, I got my master's degree in special education in teaching autism students with autism and intellectual disabilities. And then I began my career in New York City, which is where I am now. So teaching in the classroom was much harder than I expected, sort of that switch from like volunteering and this is great to like really, you know, taking ownership of what you're teaching and really feeling like you need to be there for your students every single day. So I worked as a vocational and transition teacher, which is, teaching those adaptive skills that you need to be ready for work, which I think a lot of people, when you hear that, think like the hard skills of work, like how to clean, how to do data entry, or how to do, the actual skill of working. But much more is the social skills, the soft skills of what you need to be able to do to work, to be effective at work. So learning expected behaviors in the workplace and how those expectations change from, how you act when you're at home with your family to how you act at work. There's a big change there. We talk a lot about executive functioning skills, so all the skills you need to be able to get a job done, how to prioritize work. It's actually been fascinating to learn so much about what goes into doing a job effectively. So those soft skills were really what I was teaching when I was teaching at the high school level. And then after a few years of sort of classroom teaching, I switched to work with an older population. Corey mentioned I work at AHRC New York City, which is sort of a service provider. What happens when you transition from school and education and then you become an older adult, you move on to sort of this adult, they call it adult services world. So those are, it's a very interesting, if anyone wants more information about the adult services world, I could go into it in a separate conversation. So now what I'm working on is less classroom teaching and more sort of creating those internship and vocational opportunities. And that takes a lot more, working with businesses, working with people who don't know people with disabilities. The school setting is a place where everyone cares the same about how people succeed and what their goals are. And the real world setting is a little bit different. So I'd love to talk a little bit about the Partnership for Inclusive Internships, which is the internship program where I'm working now. Here's some of our interns from a few years ago. So this project has been developed over 4 years with the New York City government with the goal of creating internship opportunities for people with disabilities to have an inroad into working for the city. And so I would say over the course of the last 20 years in the movement of disability inclusion, it's a big focus to have jobs that matter, not jobs that are not jobs where you have to create tasks for people to do because we want people with disabilities to be at work. We want to focus on jobs that really need to be done and that are, that are real and meaningful. So the city government is the largest employer of people in New York City. They have over 40,000 workers and a lot of jobs. So what we've done is worked with what started with just the New York City Department of Social Services to figure out what jobs do you have that need to be done, where are you having trouble hiring, which over the last few years has been a massive sort of, they have a lot of jobs to be filled. Looked into what jobs they have and then how we can train and work with people with disabilities to fill those jobs. So I would say we don't work only, previously my work had been primarily with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and people on the autism spectrum. Now, this internship program, it works with all types of people with disabilities. So people who are deaf or hard of hearing, people who are blind and low vision, people with physical disabilities, with mental health disabilities, other health impairments. So it's been a huge learning curve for me because, every single person is their own person. So it's really about working individually with folks to understand some of their barriers to work and then how we can break those down. And then on the other side of the coin, working with city government employees, people who will be working alongside folks with disabilities, to understand their stereotypes or why they are, uncomfortable working with people with disabilities, helping them to sort of broaden their mind. And I would say the most meaningful part of this internship program is when those supervisors or those team members come back and say, I need to hire this intern. They are so great and they have done so much work for us. They're a part of our team and they can't be replaced. And so I really believe that internships or working side by side with someone is one of the best ways to sort of change a culture and change people's minds about working with people with disabilities, what they can do and what they can achieve. Because I think many people have never met someone with a disability and they have, some in their mind, they have a thought about what they can do at work. And this kind of program really gives people the opportunity to work alongside someone they might never have worked with before. So this internship program started with the Department of Social Services. In our first year, I think we placed 30 interns, and here's a few of them. Now we've placed over 150 interns, and we work with the MTA, the Department of Homeless Services, the FDNY, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Labor, the Parks Department, and the Department of Cultural Affairs. So we're really proud of the growth that this program has created. And what started out as an opportunity to, get people with disabilities sort of in the door and that sort of networking opportunity that internships provide for everyone. All college students have an internship, and it's the same idea. That's how you kind of get your foot in the door. And for us, it's been a really successful way to move people from the sort of training and vocational, how I'm learning how to do the job, to really, now there's a job opportunity that I can pursue and people who can network for me. And to sort of move in the right direction. I think we've had close to 40 interns go on to be hired by the city, which, if you know the civil service and how the New York City government works, is a big deal. So we're really proud of this program. So that's a little bit about what I'm currently doing. And I will say that I do attribute the work that I'm doing now to, again, meeting Dan so many years ago. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this, feeling called to do something and this, kind of urge that so many years ago when I was in middle school and sort of, this path of, hey, is this what I should be doing? And it really felt like God is sort of speaking to me and saying that I think this is where your path should lead, and this is where your skills can sort of go. And I actually remember saying to my dad, when I was saying, I think I'm going to become a classroom special education teacher. And I think he said, really? Are you going to make any money doing that? Or how can you? Which is yeah. And I think the idea of, can you live in New York and do that and those kinds of things? And I said back to him, I really feel kind of called to do this. I think this is where the Spirit is leading me. And he was I can't argue with that, I guess, as a pastor. So, and there's these sort of moments in your life where you sort of feel this push in a certain direction. So this has happened again more recently. Of course, I sort of joined this career, number of years ago now, over 10 years. And just recently, I was asked to be on a podcast. The Presbyterian Church USA has a podcast, and I happen to know leader of the podcast, the speaker on the podcast. He's in a Bible study with me in New York. And so he asked if I would speak on the podcast about disability inclusion and church and what it means to have people with disabilities included in church. And I honestly was wait, what? Is this something I've never thought about? How can this be that two big parts of my life, my faith and growing up in the church, and also my work, which is working with people with disabilities, have never intersected before in a way that I've meaningfully thought about. It really actually blew my mind. So, of course, I felt I could speak to some parts of it. just through the work that I had done. But really, Nancy and Dan are the experts on this, and how I said I'd love to hear from Nancy about how she feels this plays out in her life. So here we are on the podcast. I tried to get a screenshot of when we were recording. This was all on Zoom, and when we were recording the podcast, but I couldn't get the screenshot. But over the summer, we recorded this podcast together where, you know, I just learned so much from Nancy's perspective about what disability inclusion in church means. And it really, again, I mentioned feeling sort of this push in your life, and it was one of these things that has sort of now changed, you know, the way I'm thinking about what's next in my life. So since this podcast, and I'll talk a little bit more about it, I've joined the PCUSA Committee on Presbyterians for Disability Concerns. I joined the American Association for Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Religion and Spirituality group. There's just so much literature out there on this topic and about sort of academic work on this topic. But what I keep coming back to since we recorded this podcast in the summer, and now since I've read up on all of, you know, what's the latest on this issue, it's fascinating to me that it's, you don't really need a lot of academic words to sort of describe it. It really is working with families to include people in a way that's meaningful, and it's not about a sort of one-size-fits-all, you know, way to bring people into your congregation. It's really building relationships over time, and that's something that's happened here and, you know, on this podcast episode, which again, I'll speak about, Nancy really sort of describes that. So I want to bring up this is, again, from this sort of academic literature that I've been reading up on since this podcast and learning more about faith and spirituality and people with disabilities. So this, I mean, it's not hard to understand. It's a very sort of clear circle of belonging. And the way we think about it is it starts from present. So if we're talking about including people with disabilities, we're starting with, we want people with disabilities present in our communities and in our congregations. And then it would move to, like, we want to invite people who are different to join us. And we want people to feel welcomed and known and accepted and supported. Obviously, this is sort of the way it's going. And then the most highly coveted, or the most way we can make people feel belonged, is to feel needed and to feel loved. And I think that's where not all congregations or not all communities, and I see a lot of parallels with this circle of belonging to the work I do at employment. It's one thing to sort of invite someone to join and some, you know, feel like colleagues and coworkers care about this person, but it's a really different thing for people to feel needed in a community or to feel really loved in a community. And, you know, Nancy says on the podcast a little bit about how there was a time in when we were growing up that, I don't know if it was me or Olivia or someone said that, like, Dan is my friend. And that was a place where Nancy felt like, wow, you know, to have someone who really feels like Dan is a friend, it was a unique situation for her. So I want to talk a little bit about this, the core sense of belonging in feeling needed, which is where we look to people with disabilities to take ownership of things, and we look to them to really support us back, instead of just saying, hey, this is, you know, we want you to come join us, we want you to feel like we really need you here, and you bring something to the table that's unique. So in this podcast conversation, Nancy says that we can really take great value from and learn from people like Dan, people who think differently than us. So she says, I think we learn more about faith through how faith manifests itself through someone who has very little verbal understanding, but understands vibrations in the room, understands rituals, understands concrete things. We learn more about our own faith. So I wanted to sort of tell two stories that I think illustrate this, that how we can learn from people who have a brain that thinks totally differently than ours, who think in very literal ways, and have a very literal interpretation of the rituals of our religion and how we think about our faith. So again, Nancy mentions this story that I really love about Danny talking about, trying to teach him about heaven and about death, and about how that was a really hard thing. She says, you know, at some point, people started to pass away in their life. Dan's grandmother and grandfather passed away, and Nancy said to herself, how am I going to introduce this topic to Dan, and how am I going to introduce the concept of death? Someday I'm going to die. How am I going to introduce this? So when his grandmother died, and Dan noticed this, he happened to be there when his grandma passed away, and so he said, Grandma? And Nancy said, well, Grandma went to the hospital. And then he said, burgers for dinner? And she said, yep, we will have burgers for dinner. And then he said, see Grandma? And she said, she did a little computing in her head and figured out, yes, Grandma went to heaven. You'll see her in 2090. And Dan has really great calendar skills. So he was able to say, okay, in 2090, that's when I'll see Grandma. And then Dan added New York Deli, which I guess is sort of where he went with his grandma. And she said, and Nancy said, yes, there's a New York Deli in heaven as well. And then similarly, when their cat died, he said, Rapunzel? And she said, yep, you'll see Rapunzel in 2090, and you can feed the cat in 2090. And he moved on and said, okay, that sounds good. And Nancy sort of sums it up and says, I started finding myself feeling a lot better about things all of a sudden, you know, to have this really concrete sense of faith. And Nancy said, I realized that in some ways, Dan's faith is stronger than our faith, though, for those of us who can talk ourselves in and out of things. And I love the way she summarizes that, the way that we can talk ourselves in and out of things. You know, there's this sense that we know that, you know, Jesus has promised us that there's heaven, there's life after death, but it's really, really hard to, you know, think like that when you're in moments of distress or when your emotion overrides that knowledge. And there's something that we can really learn from people who have a concrete version of faith or of their religion that say, yeah, in 2090, I'll see the people that I need to see and I'll do the things that I want to do in 2090. So I love that sort of visual reminder of how we can sort of look to people who think a little bit differently than us. And that's a need for me, at least, I think. That's something that in the circle of belonging that you're not just inviting people to come and join you. It's like, actually, I really needed to hear your perspective on that. I have another story that I think is a really interesting parallel to Nancy and Dan. So in my church in New York, I go to Broadway Presbyterian Church up on 116th Street, and I've become close with a mom and son. The son's in middle school. He's on the autism spectrum. They come together every week. They sit in the same spot every week. George really loves music, and I just see this kind of parallel between our friends Nancy and Dan. And our pastor connected me with this family because they were having trouble sort of navigating the system, and he said, I know you work in this. Can you help them with their Medicaid funding and with the different services available and connecting them? So I became close with their family more recently, but in 2020, you know, the height of the pandemic, it was probably April, so we were all home watching church on Zoom. I'm sure you remember those days. George wanted to be baptized. So at our church at Broadway, I was expecting sort of a very dainty baptism like we do here. You know, there's a font, you get a little dribble, and the font at Broadway is a little bit more like robust. It's one of those fountains that is like a magic trick that's like ever flowing. You know, the water is flowing down. There's like three little pools and rocks and everything. And our pastor Chris there does do more than a dribble. He does do like a little bit of a pour, which I didn't know. So so George requests to be baptized. It's all on TVs or on the computer, so we're watching. And Pastor Chris invites him and his mom up to the front, to the font. And I'm noticing on the computer, like, George is wearing like full-blown bathing suit, has a towel in hand, and he's like so prepared for, I think that they prepped him for, okay, this is what baptism's going to be like. You're going to be awash in God's love. And I think he took it very literally. Like, he was ready for you know, to go swimming, basically. So of course there's a point to be made, I think, about the literal interpretation of, you know, getting your bathing suit ready to be washed in God's love and everything like that. And I think that's a beautiful part of the story. But what's funny is he gets up there and Pastor Chris gets ready to sort of pour some water on his head. And he just kept saying, like, I don't want to get wet. I don't want to get wet. I don't want to get wet. Even though he had prepared for this moment. And, you know, he wasn't yelling. He wasn't distressed. It was just very matter of fact, like, nah, I'm not, I don't want to get wet today. And so Pastor Chris, I think in a moment, he was a little bit surprised. And I think his reaction was just to pour it on himself. And so to show George that, like, yeah, I'm in it too. So, you know, he has a mic on because it's all virtual. And so now the mic's getting all crackly and George is laughing at him. Like, you just poured the water on yourself. And like, it was a whole, sort of scene. So of course, like I said, I think you can take a lot of meaning from this interpretation of bringing your swimsuit to get baptized. But I think more importantly, it's sort of this literal, like this very intense moment of like, our community is not there to support you. We're all on Zoom. It's kind of hard to all be together. Yet, you know, when George is hesitant, the pastor is sort of representing our community for him and pouring the water over himself too and showing that we're all here with you and we can all do this sort of together. And I think it was one of the more meaningful baptisms I've ever witnessed because there's this, a lot of real life things going on here in that moment. And so the ritual was made more meaningful to me when we're looking at some of the more concrete ways you can think about baptism, which I don't think all of us do. I mean, for me at least, I really appreciate the rituals that we have in our faith and they've been meaningful to me. But they're not something that I like live by, that the concrete versions of them are not something that have been meaningful to me in the past. But learning from people on the autism spectrum or people with other disabilities about how they interpret these kinds of symbols and rituals has been, again, a need. It's something that has allowed me to move from, hey, you're my friend and I'm happy you're here at church, but like, wow, we really need each other to learn. And again, I want to give Nassau Church credit because I don't think, as I'm learning about this sort of faith and spirituality when it comes to disability inclusion, which is a relatively new field, I think Nassau Church was really ahead of its time when it came to inviting people in. And I was speaking recently to, there's a consultant for the PCUSA. He's the Intellectual and Developmental Disability Consultant. You know, who's hired by the PCUSA in Louisville to, you know, consult with churches when they have this kind of question. And I said, like, what's the most sort of surprising, part of the job that you're doing? And he said, well, it's not necessarily surprising, but I think a lot of churches try to create like a special class or a special little cohort where they want families or with people or children with disabilities to come to church, but we want to have a class that's specific for you. And I do think that's like kind of human nature to say like, oh, we can create this for you. But that's sort of just at the like accepted or supported kind of level. And what we're looking for is really that one-to-one. It's hard to create a relationship where like I need you and you need me when you have your own sort of special community. And again, that's where I think that our work with your work with Nancy and Dan so many years ago to create this the one-to-one support that was needed, which has blossomed into a community member that I think that we would all say is loved at our church. So I do just wanted to end on touching again on this concept of feeling called, especially for like the middle schoolers and high schoolers who are sort of thinking about like, what am I going to do in my life and where, you know, how do I know what to do? And I know that not everyone feels this push or this call to do something or other, and that doesn't happen for everyone. So I feel lucky that that's happened for me. But recently my pastor in New York, Pastor Chris, preached a sermon on Jesus being tempted by the devil in the wilderness. And it's in Matthew, the story of Jesus being led into the wilderness by Satan for 40 days and 40 nights, and it comes right after Jesus is baptized, and right after God's voice calls out and says, This is my son, my beloved, with whom I'm well pleased. So the devil then takes Jesus into the wilderness and says, you know, if you're the Son of God, command the stones to become bread. And Jesus, you know, says, one does not live by bread alone, but by the words of God. And then the devil says again, you know, takes Jesus to the pinnacle of the temple and says, if you're the Son of God, throw yourself down. And Jesus responds, don't put your Lord to the test. And then a third time, Jesus takes Jesus to a high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms and says, you know, he'll give them to Jesus if only he worships the devil. And Jesus says, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And Pastor Chris points out that this story of temptation comes right after God has just said, you're my beloved, this is my son with whom I am well pleased. And it's the very, very next voice that Jesus hears that the devil saying, if you are God's son, and highlights that if. And he says, the real temptation here is much more subtle than the three tests. Just one temptation in this story tried three times, if. Jesus is tempted to doubt his identity. He is tempted to believe he is not God's beloved child, to think that somehow God misspoke, that he misheard, that he has to prove himself. And isn't that just Satan's way? God gives us fully and freely all the love in the universe, claims us, made us in God's image, and Satan's first move is to get you to try to doubt the identity that God has given you. And that's really resonated with me as I've reflected on it, because I think it really speaks to this moment of calling. God creates us, loves us, calls us to be what we are, and then our first thought is to be like, oh, well, if I was supposed to do that, like, maybe I'd be better at this, or maybe I'd have other skills, or I'd be making more money if I did something else. So is this really what I'm supposed to be doing? And I do think that when it comes to feeling like kind of called to do something, it's not necessarily becoming a pastor. There are other things that you can feel called to do. And it does require us to sort of push past the if, you know, and think about, and the doubting, you know, and think about what is it that I'm really feeling like God is saying to me, who I am called to be by God, and trying to push past like what, you know, the other thoughts that you might have about it. And I don't think Jesus is saying like, okay, do this, you have the next 10 years figured out, right? Like it comes in slow movements. Like I said, I just recently learned about, from this podcast, I feel like I have a whole new sort of trajectory in my life. And when Jesus calls us, he doesn't say, come if you have the next 10 years figured out. He just says, like, come and do your thing. And I think that that's a really big an interesting part of feeling called, that it doesn't just, it's not like God's speaking to you from heaven, right? There's a lot of sort of questions that come with that. So that I just think it's important to remember that God's created a path for you and only asks you to follow it. You know, you don't have to have it all figured out, or you don't have to question it. So that's a little bit about my life and disability inclusion at church. And I'll turn it back over to Corey.
We are proud of you. We are impressed by you, golly. And we are grateful for you. So thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Mark, I think it might be a two-mic morning since we're a big group. Questions. We've got 6.5 minutes for questions. Bill.
Hannah, that was great. You've talked about a time in people's lives, in people with disabilities' lives, when they're young or maybe even middle-aged, but when they may have parents still there to oversee their care. What happens when they age beyond their parents?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I can only sort of speak to the service provider side of things and what that's supposed to look like is... when people with disabilities move from school to the sort of adult age, they should be connected with the state to make sure that all of the sort of funding for people with disabilities comes through state comes through Medicaid, and so they're connected with the kinds of support services that should be person-centered and well-rounded and sort of help them build a life. And then those things, whether it's like support for employment, whether it's residential care, whether it's other sorts of like community habilitation care, those things would then sort of go with you through like as you age. But it's a really tough question, and I bet Nancy could include more information on how, like what happens at a certain point when you're looking to like prepare for care for your whole life. But from a service provider and state perspective, that should be sort of all part of your life plan so that you're sorted out as you age. Yeah.
So yes, thank you, Hannah. Mm-hmm. We have this really nice model that you talked about here where we have a companion and a caretaker. What happens when you don't have a companion and you want to reach out to a person with the kind of disabilities you're talking about? How do you include them?
To include them in church? Mm-hmm. I think that the primary piece is asking, like, what do you need to feel... not only to feel welcomed here, but to join us and to feel a part of our church. I think Nancy mentions on the podcast asking for, sometimes it's hard to ask for what you need, but having to like sort of advocate and say like, these are the kinds of things I'm going to need to either for yourself or for a family member who you want to include in a church community. So really having those conversations up front with a family and trying to understand what is it that you're going to need to be have access to what we're offering here at church. Knowing that changes over a lifetime, right? So like what someone needs in 1 year might be different than next year. So always kind of updating and having those conversations. It's such a person-centered thing and really understanding what is it that you need. And that's why I think I mentioned that it's not like a super academic concept to try to get. It's sort of like, that's what the church should do, right? Is meet families where they are and just say, hey, what is it that we want you to be involved? How can we help? And what could we do?
So what if you don't have a Nancy?
Oh, if you don't have a Nancy, okay. I would say it will probably come from the other way around. So in the case with Nancy, we had Nancy advocating for what her family needed. If you had I think it's going to take on the part of you, the congregation, to ask that of the family and say, hey, we want to be there for you, and like to start that conversation, knowing that sometimes people don't ask for what they need, or knowing that sometimes people don't feel comfortable saying, hey, I really would need this to be a part, trying to be proactive and having the conversation with them and asking them directly. Which can sometimes be uncomfortable, I think, but that's, I think, really what it takes.
Got one back here. I think in answer to your question, as I think you've posed it, what happens if the individual doesn't have an advocate? And then I think really the answer, that's a hard thing, especially for an adult. If the person already has other people in their lives that are friends, you could reach out to those friends. You could get to know that person. But I think probably the best thing actually is if we all have people with disabilities in our lives in some way. So maybe that means volunteering at the Council for Exceptional Children, which is not for children. We're all children of God, so you could think of it that way. Some of the children are 50 years old, 55 years old, 60 years old. And so showing up there or volunteering at Special Olympics, and then you might develop a relationship. And once you develop that relationship, it will be a natural thing. If you're talking about your church, you could invite that person, or that person might just... you might sense or they have a need for a community, and then it will happen naturally. I know that that's not very efficient, but I know of no other way to do it except one person at a time with relationships just the way each of you came here.
Thanks, Nancy.
So perhaps another lived experience. My brother has schizophrenia, and he's over 70 years old now. It's not exactly the same issue as with autism, but fortunately his case is not so bad as some people have. But he was able actually to help take care of my mother in her last days and give her support. And although he's good enough so that he can live on his own, and the church community that he's been in has really been marvelous for him. And so that there are many people, and he's social enough that he's been able to gather friends who understand his disability. And although he doesn't communicate in the same way as some of the rest of us do, they've been very accepting and building. And it's really been a blessing for me, 1,000 miles away from him, to I stay in contact with him, but 1,000 miles away, it's sometimes hard to be there. But his church community does come in, help him, and support him. And so I think that sort of speaks to how NASA and other Presbyterian and other churches can be helpful too.
Yeah, I think it's the older I've gotten and the further away from, you know, being a, you know, having my life here at NASA, I do think you realize how it's actually kind of unique that people have such a strong church community that they're a part of. I think it's kind of, Henry and I, my husband, talk a lot about our friends don't necessarily have like that kind of thing that church community offers. I think it's kind of, it's a rare community that offers these kinds of things that people don't get everywhere else in other facets of life. So.
Hannah, thank you. You're amazing and very impressive. Thank you, Nancy, for sharing your story with Hannah so we can all learn from it. My question for you now is, you've navigated leaving the youth group and the community here, going to college, which was an incredibly different experience, and still bringing your faith through that. And I know not everybody does that. So to the high schools and middle schoolers, how did you make that work in this area?
Yeah, that's such a good question that I think about a lot. I mentioned how important going to Montreat and the youth group was to me growing up. And then there was this hole of like, what, you know, how do I find this again? And I haven't found that again, but I do feel like part of it is also learning from what you have experienced here and then bringing, you know, kind of creating it where you are. So during the pandemic, one of the reasons I got to know the gentleman who hosts the podcast that I mentioned, I said during the pandemic, like, I really wish that there was a young adult group, like people my age that I could get to know through church. And so we formed a Zoom Bible study. And now it's got a lot of the same vibes as, like, you know, youth group. You know, we log on a Wednesday. We're all eating dinner.
You play
How's
grog?
Your week? What?
You play grog?
We play, you know, I eat bad pizza, you know.
Good pizza.
And basically trying to, knowing that not everyone came from a community where they had, like, a super strong youth group and were able to build their faith that way. But I did. And so I can say, like, hey, what if we got together on a Wednesday night over Zoom? Some of the older folks in our congregation don't love Zoom, but it's like, for me, Zoom is great. I can Zoom from my couch and have a Bible study with you. And so that part has been really kind of like trying to make it, I'm not trying to recreate my youth group years and like my Montreat camp experience, but it is nice to know that you have the resources to say, hey, this was really meaningful to me back then. Are there things I can do now as an adult to bring that back? And I will say, like, getting to know, it's not easy post-pandemic, especially to like try to build those relationships at church. Again, being now we're back in person, and it's hard to make adult friends. It's like nice to have a built-in friend crew when you're in youth group. So it does take some work, but you have the ability to create it as well.
Thank you, Hannah.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. We've got one last round of stories to hear next week. Next week is Assistant Provost for Diversity, Equity, Inclusion at the University, Michelle Minter, who is an active leader in Witherspoon Street Church, and we are going to welcome her and are excited to hear her story. Again, Hannah, you are appreciated. We are grateful.